Our second case for this morning is United States against Barta and others. Maybe we'll wait just a second while the courtroom clears out, and then Mr. Rubenstein.
May it please the court, Corey Rubenstein on behalf of James Barta, counsel. Your honors, Jim Barta was entrapped as a matter of law. As this court and the Supreme Court have explained again and again, one's lack of disposition to engage in an offense before coming into contact with government agents is really the essence of entrapment. Or in the words of this court, in the Piatto case, lack of predisposition distinctively reveals whether one has been entrapped. The government's unprecedented, perhaps, concession here that Mr. Barta was not predisposed to engage in this offense amounts to a concession of entrapment itself, given the undeniable acts of inducement by the government over the 6 or 7 months of this investigation.
But you know, the difference between this case and many is that the district court here agreed that it was appropriate to give an instruction to the jury on entrapment. Often the government jumps in and files a motion in limine and it never reaches the jury, at which point you say, well, a rational jury might have thought there was entrapment. Here, of course, our perspective needs to be much different. We need to assume no predisposition, but also look to see if a rational jury could have found that the government didn't do anything to induce him. They just, in a sense, set the table and he sat down and started to eat.
That's correct, Judge, and this is a unique case. In fact, I don't know that there's ever been a case where the government has conceded predisposition, so we don't see cases like that on appeal.
But you would agree, though, that if a jury could find, or maybe you can tell me that you don't agree with this, but if a jury could find that nothing the government did amounted to inducement, which of course is a term of art in the law of entrapment, then the jury could reject the defense, couldn't it?
It could, but it couldn't in this case.
There's no, why not?
Because there's no question that there was government inducement. The government doesn't even challenge that there were acts of government inducement all along the way.
Define what you mean by inducement then. Maybe that would be a good starting point.
Sure, Judge. Where there's no predisposition, complete absence of predisposition, government inducement is any action of the government beyond merely presenting an opportunity to commit an offense, beyond merely setting the table, that causes the defendant to engage in the offense. And we're way beyond merely presenting an opportunity here. The government did that in March of 2012. The first time that there was any contact with Mr. Barta was March of 2012. It wasn't until June. And even in June, Judge, the government agent acknowledged on cross-examination that I knew by as late as June 5th that Mr. Barta was not on board with the offense. And that agent knew that because in candid conversations with Mr. Buenrostro, who kept telling him, you know what, I got to catch Mr. Barta in the right mood. He's skeptical. He doesn't think it can be done. I think it can be done, but he doesn't. And you know what else Mr. Buenrostro tells him? I've got another guy waiting in the wings. If this falls through, then we'll
use... But there's a difference between reluctance to commit a crime and believing that the particular crime is unlikely to be productive, right? He didn't seem worried about, you know, bribery. He seemed to be worried that, you know, it wasn't a clever scheme, right?
Well, that
suggests a willingness to engage in illegal activity if provided with a more promising opportunity.
Of course, the willingness has been conceded. And Judge, reluctance isn't an element. I mean, Your Honors in Hollingsworth and in quoting to the Supreme Court in Jacobson made very clear the defendant doesn't have to evidence reluctance. What's important is when predisposition is gone, it's conceded, you got to look at the government's conduct. And over the course of this investigation, the government engaged in all of these affirmative acts to keep it alive.
So how many times, so you seem to think that Mr. Castro, you know, the identity Mr. Castro, called Mr. Barta too many times, you know, or emailed him or whatever. But focusing on that March date, how many contacts from the government do you count up?
From March until...
From March until the time he finally writes the check for $6,500.
Well, there's two meetings, Judge.
Two meetings.
You're talking about direct contacts?
Right, yeah.
Okay. Two meetings, a phone call which does go through and which Mr. Barta takes without knowing who it is. Five other phone calls which leave a message for Mr. Barta to his assistant and beg his assistant, he's got to call me back, he's got to call me back, he's got to let me know. And then five emails where he makes the same request. In each of those emails, and they start from May 16th, right after the second meeting, all the way until, I think, June 12th, Judge. In each one of those emails, the government, and of course it's not the undercover agent who writes them, it's a squad of FBI agents. In each one of those emails, the email is directed to Mr. Barta and says, at the beginning, it's a little softer, we await your response. But by the end, Judge, on June 12th, it's, Jim, you've got to call me today. If you don't call me today and let me know that you're on board, I'm going to move on. My guy's going to move on. Of course, Mr. Barta doesn't call him. The agent calls Barta when he doesn't hear from him.
And that's when they all fly out to Nebraska?
No, that's later. Is that because Barta just says we'll schedule a meeting in that phone call. He doesn't say I'm on board. And then he cancels the meeting, right?
Correct, Judge.
Okay. My concern here, Mr. Rubenstein, is it seems to me that after March 21 and May 9 meetings, you've got plenty of inducement. You've got sweeteners of the deal. It's not going to be 1 million prescriptions a year. It's going to be 2 or million or 3 million. We're going to, you know, $12, $13 a script. It's going to be a great deal for you. But the government is arguing, as I understand it here, we think we actually had him in the conspiracy as of March 21st. First time we meet him, he learns that some sort of payment to a public official will be needed, and he says, I understand several times. Couldn't a jury find he's a member of the conspiracy at that point? What do you have to say in response to that theory, the March 21st conspiracy theory?
Yes, Judge. And the district court judge definitely says that in his mm-hmm. post-trial order. I don't know that the government ever takes up on that. In fact, throughout the brief, their brief, they talk about his willingness to conspire. Mm-hmm. But even if you take that as having been the government's argument, and I don't think it was, first of all, we know from the government's own conduct, the government's own language, both during the course of the investigation and at trial, that wasn't what they believed. Judge, in closing argument in the trial, the government acknowledged, and now this was in the discussion of the venue question, but the government acknowledged that, you know, when Rostro and Medrano had their own conspiracy, they hatched it in the earlier part, and that went through the March meeting and thereafter. Barta didn't join until sometime later, whether it's the 9th of May or at the very, very latest, that phone call on the 12th. So at trial, the government doesn't claim that the conspiracy, that Mr. Barta was part of any conspiracy in March. More importantly, Judge, the agent in his testimony said he wasn't on board till June. And at the March meeting, remember, the government set the terms for this March meeting. The government, the night before, says Barta needs to bring the cash to the meeting. This is going to be not just a kickback, this is going to be an advance payment bribe. Barta shows up, of course, there is no cash. What does the agent say to Mr. Buenrostro in private after, and I call it a meeting, by the way, this was a 12-minute introduction while Barta is on the way to the airport with Buenrostro. At the end of the meeting, after Barta leaves, the agent turns to Mr. Buenrostro and says, in essence, where was the cash? I'm not going to know he's serious until he comes across with a cash. The government set the terms. And the same thing with the May meeting. There's demands.
Wait, I've lost the thread. So the government says, this is page 11 of its brief, after Barta and Buenrostro left, Medrano said that Barta had told Medrano, I'm open to anything. I'm open to anything. Whatever it is, whatever it takes from me, as long as it's profitable. I have no problem with it. So he had a problem of the profitability, the size of the contract. But he seemed very willing to engage in this bribery if it would be sufficiently lucrative to justify the risk.
Well, even if you assume that the jury could reach that conclusion, that's not the existence of a conspiracy. There's no agreement to do anything at that meeting. Mr. Barta from the...
So isn't it the case, though, I mean, I happen to agree with you that the record is very fuzzy, and I'll be asking the government about this, too, about exactly when we're supposed to think Barta joined the conspiracy. But once he's, if a jury could conclude that he did join the conspiracy, then aren't the statements of co-conspirators from a time prior to his joining admissible against him?
Judge, I don't think that's right. I don't think prior to, unless he could have foreseen that they were in
right,
furtherance
within
of
the
conspiracy.
Right, scope, you know, reasonably foreseeable. In other words, he joins this existing agreement.
And even if you assume that, Judge, if you look at the statements that Medrano and Buenrostro make before that March meeting, remember, the government in December says, we want to have, my guy wants to have a meeting with the decision maker of SaveRx. And Mr. Medrano says, no, this is going to be just me, you, and Gus. SaveRx isn't involved in anything until March, till the night before the meeting. I see I'm in my rebuttal time. I'd like to reserve the remainder.
Sure. That's fine. No, first we're going to have, I think, Ms. Pisetsky. Mr. Pisetsky.
May it please the court. My name is Gal Pisetsky. I represent Ambrosio Medrano. Counsel. Mr. Medrano was sentenced to 30 months consecutive sentenced to 126 months from case number 12 CR 459. In this case, Mr. Barta was sentenced to 21 months and Mr. Buenrostro was sentenced to 18 months. Your Honors, I believe that the judge and the district court made a mistake, erred when he sentenced Mr. Medrano to a consecutive rather than a concurrent sentence of 30 months.
But here's my problem with that argument. You appear to agree that there is discretion that the district court possesses to decide whether a sentence will be concurrent or consecutive to an earlier sentence. And it seems to me entirely rational for a district court to think that some marginal punishment is called for by a new crime. And the only way you get marginal punishment is to make the sentence, at least in part, consecutive. So I'm having trouble imagining where the abuse of discretion is, even if you might not have done that or I might not have done that. But why wasn't that permissible?
Well, I do. The answer, your original statement, I agree with you. The judge does have discretion. However, despite the fact that the judge has discretion, this court said in Jackson that he needs to, when a judge sentences somebody, especially when the judge sentenced somebody to a consecutive sentence and makes some comments about it, there needs to be a discussion by the judge.
Did you give us the sentencing transcript?
I did, and I believe that the district judge contradicted himself.
I've got it. Where did he contradict himself? I don't think it's in the appendices.
It's not in the appendices.
No. It would have been helpful in the appendices, but it's not there. So.
On page 60 of the transcript, of the sentencing transcript, for example, the judge says, I must consider, however, that Mr. Medrano now has been sentenced to and faced an undischarged term of imprisonment of 126 months, and my analysis of 3553A factors really has to consider the fact as well. However, on page 67...
And then he goes on page 61, I think this is actually quoted in the briefs, he talks exactly about marginal punishment. He says, you know, I have to consider this earlier sentence. I don't think it should all be consecutive, but I think additional time is necessary, otherwise there'd effectively be no punishment. So,
And then later on page 67, His Honor says, the fact that the fact that he was sentenced to a sentence that is presumably lawful, and I'm making no comment, and I have no idea if there are any appellate issues with regard to that sentence or not, but on the assumption that the sentence was lawful, and that Mr. Medrano has to spend 10.5 years in prison as a result of that conviction, that is no way ties this court's hands and has really any relevance to this court's independent evaluation of the 3553 factors. And so I see it as a contradiction.
It obviously didn't tie his hands, but it's very clear from this transcript that Judge Tharp gave this careful consideration, concluded that some marginal punishment was needed, didn't go for the phony 60 months that you proposed concurrent, which would have provided no punishment, and said, in essence, in the interests of transparency and sentencing, I'll cut it to 30, but I'll make it consecutive. And you still wind up with a total sentence that's below the guidelines for the Cook County case, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So how is any of this remotely an abuse of discretion?
Because under the guidelines, specifically 5G1.3, Your Honor, the judge needs to engage in a discussion as to how it is.
What did he fail to say?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that when he talked about the 3553 factors, he did discuss them as to the reasoning why he is imposing an actual sentence, but he did not discuss those factors as to the consecutive sentence.
Does he have to do it again? He says, I mean, he goes through a very detailed account, and Medrano is unique, right? Three-time loser on public corruption charges, right?
That's true, Your Honor.
Judge Tharp hasn't seen anything like it before, and nobody in the district has seen this before. It's very individualized. What does he have to repeat when he says some marginal punishment is needed?
Well, I believe I see that I'm
out of time,
but I will answer that question.
You need to answer the judge's question.
I will answer that by saying that he was in the same shoes when he was in front of Judge Feinerman just 2 days earlier on Friday for sentencing, and Judge Feinerman did find that Mr. Medrano accepted responsibility, and he gave Mr. Medrano a below guideline sentence.
He pled guilty in that case, right?
He did plead guilty.
He went to trial in this one.
Sure, but
and you say it was an abuse of discretion not to give acceptance of responsibility here, right?
I think that you don't have to. Just because you exercise your right to a trial,
no, you don't
mean that
have
you don't.
That's right. But how is it an abuse of discretion not to grant acceptance?
The abuse of discretion, in my opinion, Your Honor, is the fact that Judge Tharp did not address the 5G1.3 factors as they were.
What did he miss? I asked you that before. What did he miss?
He missed the fact that, for example, Mr. Medrano was sentenced in front of Judge Feinerman on the Dermophil issues, and he recalculated and talked about his criminal background. Mr. Medrano's guideline calculation.
Judge Tharp talked about all of that.
And then he, of course, he talks about it when he finds the guideline issues, when he determined what the guideline is, which takes into account his terrible criminal background. There's no doubt about that. It takes into account 3553. But then this court said that after you do that, after you determine the 3553 factors, and after you determine the guidelines, you still have to have a meaningful discussion as to the reasoning why it's a concurrent sentence, and not just because the criminal history of an individual. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, am I correct? Is somebody here from Mr. Buenrostro?
Yes, Your Honor. Richard replaced Mr. Buenrostro. I adopted the arguments of common interest in the other briefs, not
all right. Thank you very much. Mr. Stettler.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Chris Stettler, and I represent the United States. This was not a crime that the government initiated. This was not a crime in which the government recruited defendant Barda into the conspiracy.
But it's a troubling story because it takes Mr. Barda quite a while to walk into the trap, and it's not clear to me. The government's very insouciant about, you know, when did he really join the conspiracy? Could have been March, could have been May, could have been June. And there's this pestering. Until you get that check from him, you don't pounce. And I think it's a troublesome case.
Well, there's nothing wrong with the government to continue an investigation, even after parties have entered into a conspiracy.
Well, if you put it that way, of course, but, you know, is there anything at all wrong every time somebody says no to up the ante? Well, it's not going to be 1 million prescriptions, it's going to be 2, it's going to be, you know, better and better. How much of that can go on?
In this case, Judge, there was never a no from Defendant Barta. In fact,
there was never what? I didn't hear you.
There was never a no.
And there wasn't a yes until he writes the check.
Well, there's a yes even before that March 21st meeting, Your Honor. That's the first meeting at which the government is face-to-face or even communicates whatsoever with Defendant Barta.
It's not really a yes, though.
Is it your theory that he joined the conspiracy before the March 21st meeting?
It's our theory, consistent with what Judge Tharp found, Your Honor, that at least by that first meeting, Defendant Barta is a part of that conspiracy.
Here's what troubles me about that, okay? That seems to be completely inconsistent with the way you presented the case to the jury. As Mr. Rubenstein said, your agent says even into early June, Barta's not on board yet. And you try the case to the jury, taking full advantage, of course, naturally, of the fact that he wrote that check in the June 22nd meeting after all of the inducements, at least following the May 9 meeting. And now you're trying to defend the conviction based on a radically different approach.
Well, I would disagree with the characterization of the undercover agent's answer to whether or not Mr. Barta was a part of the conspiracy. He does say, the undercover agent does say, that as of June 7th, Mr. Barta wasn't, quote, on board. And the agent was very specific in his testimony that there was a distinction between whether or not Mr. Barta was on board with paying the bribe, which he was all along, and whether or not Mr. Barta was on board in terms of every detail of the contract that they were going to get.
The detail was the payment that your agent kept saying was necessary to get the ball rolling. It was without that, the deal doesn't go forward, right? And Barta keeps not paying.
The details that the agent was referring to, in fact, the agent does say that Barta was on board the whole time with paying the bribe, and that's... That's
not the way you all argued the case. You argued it with a much later joining of the conspiracy, right?
I don't think that's accurate either, Your Honor. What we said.
What am I not remembering from your closing about venue? Where did we go here?
What the government argued in its opening close, and I believe this is referred to in Mr. Barta's submission.
Then Barta joins at some point later, whether it's on the 9th, that is of May, or the very, very latest, that phone call on June 12th. There are acts in Chicago that show that venue is proper.
And Judge, if you look up to the beginning of that paragraph, which puts that comment in context, there's a reference there to Medrano and Buonarroto being on board at some point in late 2011.
Clearly they were on board much earlier.
Right, and so there's a reference.
But it's Barta that we're talking about. And
they don't have an entrapment defense.
No.
Correct.
I'm not arguing entrapment.
And what I want to make clear, Your Honor, is that statement, read in context, is that at some point Mr. Barta joins after, it's not after March 21st, 2012, or some point after that, it's after Buonarroto and Medrano have agreed to pay this bribe, and that was in December of 2011.
That's not what
it
says.
No.
That's not what it says.
And Barta joins at some point later, whether it's on the 9th, which it clearly was not, or at the very, very latest, that phone call on June 12th. Okay. I listened to that June 12th phone call this morning, and Barta says, I'm probably ready to move. We'll schedule a meeting. The meeting gets scheduled. He cancels even that. He's not on board even then.
Judge, I would disagree that he's canceling these meetings because he's at all...
What word do you use? He doesn't show up. He doesn't... He tells them it's off.
I mean, in essence, what limits are there on the government's persistence?
And again, there's a distinction between whether or not Mr. Barta is on board with the bribe payment prior to that point. So I think there's a distinction of if he is on board from the very beginning.
Does he have a history of briberies or criminal activities? Or?
Judge, there were some activities that were raised at sentencing, which was not part of the trial record, obviously. But if Your Honor would like me
it's
to...
It's not you, part of the trial?
You correct.
And you admitted no predisposition?
Correct, Your Honor.
I've never heard of that before.
And Judge, I do believe
but
that...
But see, isn't the standard sting is where you have good reason to believe a person is a criminal, and what you're trying to do is arrange the type of crime that he commits, but obviously in a situation where you catch him, right? It's the typical thing. The bicycle thief. So you leave a bicycle, you know, out on the street without a lock near where he lives, and he snaps it up, and you arrest. That's perfectly lawful. You're just arranging for a career criminal to commit his crime in a way that he can be caught easily. But Barta doesn't seem to fit that. If he doesn't have a history of, you know, giving large bribes, isn't that a problem for you?
It's
not,
Judge.
You don't want to go around on the street to complete strangers and, you know, try to induce them to commit crimes. That's not proper law enforcement, is it?
It's certainly not what the government does, Judge, to target innocent individuals.
So you have all these conversations that Barta is part of, but he's very ambiguous in them. And he's
cagey.
Yeah, he's cagey. He's listening, but you take those statements and you think that a jury could regard them as, yes, I'm on board, you know, who do I have to pay to get this L.A. business? I don't see that.
Well, Judge, even before the March 21st meeting, and I think it is in any entrapment case, the facts are extremely important. So before the very first phone call in this case, which again, it's not the government out there targeting an innocent individual. It is a uniquely corrupt individual in Ambrosio Medrano who reaches out on his own without any urging by the government, and he specifically mentions SaveRx being a part of a corrupt contract. And then you have another
meeting. And Mr. Barta does nothing.
At that point...
Can you prove... by statements being made back in November and December that Barta is a part of the conspiracy at that time?
Judge, the law in this circuit is that if there's a conspiracy, even if somebody isn't a member of the conspiracy at that point, 801 D2E statements are admissible against people who join at some later point. So there's no problem in terms of using that first phone call with respect to Mr. Barta, and it's also part of the...
So what a future co-conspirator makes up hopes that he'll be able to bring somebody in is enough, at least if he gets the help from the team of FBI agents in preparing the scripts and luring this guy in. Those statements back in prior to the March 21st meeting, you think, can prove that Barta was part of the conspiracy back then?
Sure, and just to be clear, that November 23rd...
That seems completely circular to me.
In that November 23rd conversation wasn't the only indication that Mr. Barta was on board. So you have
But you are saying, though, that if back in November they had a conversation, Medrano and Gwen Rosewood had a conversation in which they said, yes, Barta's totally on board, he's going to help us bribe the L.A. health people, and Barta never, ever, ever does anything. You still could have indicted him for being a member of the conspiracy because you think a jury could have believed based on this that he joined the conspiracy and that he was intending to bribe, perhaps.
I can't imagine us charging that kind of case, but in terms of whether or not a statement is admissible at that point under 801 D2E, it is. No, and then also
the question is whether you can prove conspiracy, prove individual A's conspiracy membership based on what B and C have said.
Correct.
And nothing more.
Correct. And then also, Judge, you have...
And you're saying, yes, you can, even if there's nothing more.
I'm sorry, I may be confused about the distinction between 801D2E and the sufficiency of the evidence. Let me put to one side the admissibility.
I'm focusing on sufficiency of the evidence to prove BARDA. Forgive me if my questions weren't as precise as they should have been.
No, it was my misunderstanding, and I apologize.
But I don't see how you can prove BARDA is a member of the conspiracy based on back in November and December, based on what the other two guys say, when your own theory is that he joins much, much later.
So we also have, in addition to the November 23rd conversation, there's phone records that show all of these people are in contact. Medrano to Buonarrostro, Buonarrostro to BARDA, and then at...
Buonarrostro and BARDA have a relationship that goes back 20 years, right?
That's correct.
So,
And I think most definitively, not only do you have the November 23rd, you have the December 15th, at which Mr. Buonarrostro says, we're going to get the owner of SaveRx involved. That's at page 6 of
but
that.
But he's just hoping. He doesn't even say it's happened yet.
Correct.
His intent.
Scary theory, I got to say.
Well, and then it takes us, Judge, to the night before the first meeting. Medrano again says Mr. BARDA is on board. And I think most importantly, Your Honors, is that during that 12-minute meeting, and yes, it's a very short introductory meeting, but it's very clear during that meeting that it's going to take a bribe to get this contract. And Mr. BARDA says he understands. He says he understands.
He doesn't say no, and that's why he's in federal prison today, mm-hmm. right? But he also doesn't say yes, and he doesn't come across with the cash that your guy was expecting. Right?
Well, the night before, Mr. Medrano says, I don't think that I'm going to be able to get a hold of him before that meeting. And, in fact, the phone records show that there was no phone call between Mr. Medrano and Mr. BARDA in that intervening time. You also have... Mr. BARDA is saying at the end of that meeting that he would expect a bribe to be part of the contract, and he says upon leaving, I hope we can do some business. Following that brief introductory meeting, you have Mr. BARDA being taken back to the airport by Mr. Buonarrostro. During that trip to the airport, Mr. BARDA tells Buonarrostro, I'm not scared about making this bribe payment.
Where does that testimony? You are putting words in his mouth. He never uses the word bribe.
What?
I mean, I get the impression that he's trying to draw them out, find out what they're talking about, look cool, you know, a number of things that are short of saying, you know, let's pay off a corrupt LA official and get this juicy business.
He does not use the term bribe, but the testimony was, so first of all, the statement was that Mr. BARDA wasn't afraid of the retainer. And that was a term that, according to the undercover agent, was a code name for the bribe. And Mr. Medrano referred to a retainer throughout these discussions because, among other reasons, that Mr. Medrano had expressed concerns about law enforcement finding out what was happening. You also have, on March 30th, Mr. Medrano reaching out to the government, and also, the government never reaches back out to the defendants following all of these indications of...
Nobody thinks you have a problem with respect to Medrano or Buonarrostro. The problem is BARDA.
So on March 30th, following that very explicit discussion about the bribe payment and Mr. BARDA wanting to do business with these individuals, Mr. Medrano reaches out to the cooperating individual. And he says at that point, hey, we're ready to move forward. We want to know what it is that Mr. Castro can do. And at that point, there is no government inducement. There's no contacts with Mr. BARDA. There's no discussion about what this contract is going to entail, how profitable it's going to be. So I think even before that March 30th conversation, it's very clear Mr. BARDA wants to do business that's corrupt.
Would you agree that the government's proposals to double the price of the proposed contract in Los Angeles and to increase the volume after the May 9th meeting qualify as inducement?
I believe they are inducements. I think that on its
so
own.
So that means you've got to show in that you had him on board before then. And you're right?
I don't think so, because I think it still depends on whether or not, looking at both objective and subject factors unique to this case, that would be the kind of thing that would blind Mr. Barta to his legal obligations. And even Mr. Barta says, I don't care
not
about...
Not blind, but induce, okay? It's more than... We're talking about simply presenting more than an opportunity, but continuing to push. It's opportunity plus. And you've clearly got that after May 9th, right?
You've got this rehearsal in Mr. Barta's reply brief of six different, you know, bullet points, more or less, of what the government was doing from that point onward. Pushing,
yeah.
pushing.
And I think it's inconsistent with what a rational jury could conclude from those facts. It wasn't the government pushing. It was, overall, there was one...
By doubling the price and tripling the quantity? That's not pushing? When somebody has... so far repeatedly declined opportunities to make the payment you said was necessary.
And I would disagree with the characterization that he had declined to make the payment. He
hadn't made it.
He had not made it by that point, but he had agreed by March 21st at the latest to be a part of this conspiracy. And I think even after the May 9th meeting...
Is that what you told the jury? March 21st, he's joined the conspiracy?
Well, we told the jury, Judge, and just to be clear, the lawyer's statements, as Judge Tharp instructed the jury, is not evidence.
I get that. Believe me, I've given that instruction plenty of times. But I have a very serious problem with your asking us to affirm a conviction that has put a man in prison today on a theory that was never presented to the jury and, in fact, conflicts with the theory you presented to the jury.
And even if you look at the government's closing argument on that point, Judge...
I have. All of it.
There is a point in the opening close where Mr. Grimes, who gave that closing argument, said, it's very clear that by March 21st, 2012, Mr. Barta had been briefed about what had happened.
That's clear. There's no doubt. He didn't walk into that meeting cold. And as I say, he didn't say no. That's why he's in prison today. He's willing to talk about this, which is dangerous. But your own agent says he's not on board even into June.
And I strongly disagree with the characterization that he wasn't on board in terms of being a part of the conspiracy at that point. It was very clear, even above and beyond what the agent said about Mr. Barta being on board with the bribe payment all along, that the agent's statement about not being on board was about the specific terms of the contract. Mr. Barta is always on board with paying the bribe. He joined the conspiracy on March 21st. He says, I hope we can do some business. And then at each point thereafter, he continues to discuss, he continues to engage in discussion about the specific terms of the contract. The agreement to pay the bribe has already been made. He makes that very clear throughout these discussions. On May 9th...
I don't hear it.
On May 9th, Your Honor, in fact, he says there's a point where he's talking to the undercover agent towards the end of the meeting about next steps, and he makes very clear, look, I don't have any concern about making this bribe payment.
What exactly did he say?
Judge, I can bring...
And by the way, if you can tell us where we find the transcripts in the record, we've got the recordings, but I'm not sure where the transcripts are.
I can submit that to the court, Judge. My understanding was that Mr. Barta had submitted those. I apologize.
This court does not physically have those transcripts, and I don't see them docketed in the district court. But we will need to see those.
Definitely. And Judge, if you look at the May 9th, 2012 meeting, and I'm at page 62, line 7, this is Mr. Castro saying, my main thing is, my guys, he's not going to move on anything until we agree on something, and he sees something come across, basically. And Mr. Barta responds, we understand that, and that's not the problem. and then he continues to discuss about how
he's got other problems, right?
Unrelated to his,
whether it's going to be profitable, whether there's anything, any need for their services in LA, right?
Actually, the only thing he specifies is whether or not the corrupt official is going to get into trouble, and that's on page 64. And he says at line 15, and your friend, referring to the corrupt official, wouldn't want to put him in a position. You want to put him in a position where he comes out a hero. See that my time is up. I can answer any additional questions.
If there are any additional questions, that's...
Yes. Red brief, page 31. You say Barta was willing to... Barta was willing to pay a bribe before he communicated with a government agent or knew what a bribe would buy him. And I guess my question is, how is that consistent with your concession at trial that he was not predisposed?
Well, I think the concession at trial was that the predisposition that we were referring to related to the initiation of the investigation, so November 23rd of 2011.
What? When did you make that specific?
We did not make it that specific, Your Honor.
I find that utterly inconsistent with everything else I've read in the briefs, but we'll let it go. Okay.
We'd ask for,
and in the record.
And we ask that the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Stettler. Anything further, Mr. Rubenstein?
Your Honor, Mr. Pisetsky has offered to cede me any remaining time he has as well, if the court would be inclined. Okay. Judge, in the period before the March meeting, the government makes the point throughout their brief, Barta's never mentioned. The government didn't even know who Barta was, which we find hard to believe. But in any event, the fact is, Medrano and Buenrostro, when they meet on the 15th of December, they're freelancers. They're talking about toilet paper and hospital beds and medical supplies.
So let me ask you this, Mr. Rubenstein. Do you think a jury could... or would be entitled to construe all of these veiled statements that Mr. Barta makes in the March meeting and the May encounters, the things, you know, I know what you're talking about, I'm ready. I mean, he never, of course, uses clear language. But could a jury construe that as veiled references to his willingness to go forward with the bribe?
Willingness? Judge, obviously we don't think so. The jury may have disagreed, but willingness isn't an agreement. There's no conspiratorial agreement at that point. Your Honor, when Mr. Barta enters the March meeting, what's the first thing he says? He says, I'm not trying to sell you anything. Gus asked me to come and tell you what we do. I don't know where we would fit into your operation at all. Gus asked me to come, and I thought I'd come. The agent's the one who says, there's always opportunities for new business ventures. If you guys are interested, and Barta says, yeah, we're always interested. We're very interested, anytime. There's no question, Judge, as Mr. Barta's sitting there, and as Judge Posner recognized, he's a savvy businessman. He's been around. There was plenty of evidence in the record, Your Honor, that the normal practice in this industry is the use of brokers and consultants. And he's dealt with them a million times. And it doesn't take a leap to think all these people say, I've got a guy, I've got a guy. So is Mr. Barta there? Is he hearing this? There's no question, okay? Does he accept it? No. Does he agree to the terms the government put out that you've got to come forward with this advance payment and then we'll know we have an agreement and then we'll know we're ready to move? No. Your Honor, that's all I have unless there are any other questions by the court.
Apparently not. Thanks to both counsel and Mr. Pisetsky, you were appointed, were you not?
I was.
We appreciate your help to the court and to the client. We will take the case under advisement.